You have to realize what your momentum is going to do. And you've got to start turning that oil tanker before it seems to be any danger. And that's where we are right now. We actually have some time. We have a very short period of time where we could turn. But we have to be able to see what's going to come. We have to be able to connect somehow to what will happen. The oil tanker that we're on, by the time it hits that shore, we're dead. What incentive do we have? What incentive do we have to take action now? That's the great challenge, actually. It's a cultural challenge. In terms of what we can do, there's lots of stuff people can do, right? The question is not what we can do. There's lots of answers to what we can do. The question is, do we have the will to make those changes? Do we have the motivation to make those changes? Do we have the motivation to make short-term sacrifices? And there will be short-term sacrifices that have to be made for the survival of the world, for the survival of civilization. As Robert Heilbronner says, there are many who would sacrifice much for their children. Fewer would do so for their grandchildren. How do we make those connections? How do we, as I said, reach across generations? Right? There's no easy answers to this, because in fact, the ground on which we will come up with answers, the ground on which we think, is dominated by advertising. The lens through which we will look at the world is dominated by this idea, these stories that says, buy now, more debt. To the extent that it encourages us to think about the future, it encourages us to think about tomorrow, possibly the day after. Think 10 years down the road. Think next year. Corporations can't think that long. Corporations are driven by what their profits are going to be and, this quarter. So the people who are in charge of our policy are literally blind to the dangers that we will see. They literally can't, they are legally not allowed to be able to look 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years down the road. Politicians should do that. Okay, that actually is what politicians should be doing. That is the role that they should have. But the major actors within the marketplace don't do that. The major discourse that surrounds us is about now, immediacy. It's about desire. It's about being happy now, not in 10 years' time. How do we develop these alternative ways? That's the great challenge. And the problem is, it's how do you get an addict? We're all addicted, by the way. We're addicts. When George Bush said America is addicted to oil, he was right. About the only time he was right in 8 years, but he was one time telling the truth. America actually is addicted to oil. Right? If that's true, we're addicts. We're addicted. How does an addict find help? An addict is really dangerous, by the way, of course. Because once you're addicted, you will do anything to feed your habit. 1 million dead Iraqis? No problem. War as a permanent state? No problem, right? That is what addicts do. Addicts will do anything. And that is exactly what we're doing. From the perspective of the dealer, okay, once you know you have a population of addicts out there and they're addicted to something that you have, if you're controlling something, then violence is what will maintain your control. So from both the perspective of the addict and the dealer itself, right, how do we get out of this situation? Just on oil, right? If there's any doubt of why America is in occupations in both Iraq and Afghanistan, if Afghanistan, if you think it has anything to do with Osama bin Laden and the Taliban, you've got to be. It is such a patently false argument to make. Obama is still making it. He must cringe every time he has to make it. Right? George Bush didn't know any better. Obama is a smart guy and knows. And yet, because of the position he's in, he's forced to actually say those things, to make these idiotic statements about what the Afghan war is about. We'll see what he says. He says, we have to get people to see clearly soon. He just said that today. He's going to make a statement around Afghanistan. I'm actually dying to see what that statement is going to be and whether he's going to be. I know exactly what that statement is going to be. It's not going to be the real. It's not going to be an intellectually honest statement. You don't get elected to be president of the United States as a radical. Sorry to disappoint anyone who voted for him on that basis. Obama is a brand. He makes us feel good. A lot of people feel good about, right? He's a brand. But brands are simply that. Brands are brands. Brands are ideas. They're not policy institutions. Okay, getting out of this situation will require enormous work. And one response may just be to say, we'll just enjoy the end of the world. You know, one last great fling. One party to end all parties. As Frederick Jameson, the literary theorist, says, it is easier for people to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. And that is a failure of imagination. That is because our cultural field has given us a limited set of visions to imagine the future. The alternative response, a long time ago, Marx said, there are two possible futures for humankind. There are no guarantees in history. Okay, there are no guarantees in history. History will not work itself out in some abstract way and it'll be okay at the end. What Marx said was, he observed that there were two directions that capitalism could take. Towards what he called communism, but a democratic socialism, or a brutal barbarism. Socialism or barbarism. Those are the choices that Marx gave at the end of the 19th century. At the start of the 21st century, those choices have never been starker. They've never been starker. Where our future lies will depend upon what we do. It'll depend upon the answers that we came up with. It'll depend upon the clear-headedness of our analysis. And it'll depend upon whether we are willing and able to envision different worlds. That is as much fun, that is as much about pleasure, that is as sexy, that motivates people as much as the consumer culture does. That's a challenge. It's not, people aren't going to be motivated from duty. People will be motivated because it's the fun thing to do. And I think the left and progressives, we've not been very good on fun. We've not been very good on pleasure. Democratic socialism will really be fun. It'll be really fun. People will be much, much happier because we will stress things that actually make people happy, which is social connection. We will have, you know, it'll be community that's stressed. It'll be democratic participation that's stressed. In terms of where resources go, it'll be education that's stressed, which is what people want. It'll be healthcare that's stressed. So people will be able to get exactly, I think, what human beings want.
And thanks to Active Ingredients, that's activeingredients.org, for that talk, which I edited slightly to remove hesitations and pauses. Now we return to Kenneth Doust's adaptation of the film Obey.
Corporations have seized power from the hands of the citizens, that the constitutions and all guarantees of personal liberty have become irrelevant, and that the phrase consent of the governed is meaningless. We experience nothing more than hollow acts of political theatre, all happening under the guise that democratic debate continue to exist, when in fact they do not. This is the world as it is. It is global and it is what we obey. The vague and unspecific promise of a better tomorrow is all that politicians have left to offer. It is only with this system of unfettered capitalism that they promise us the brighter future that awaits us, our brave new world. This is the future of the current system. This is the future of obedience. In the coming years, corporate power will continue to pollute and poison the ecosystem and propel us into a world where there will be only masters and serfs. There will be no check to a system of governance designed to enrich a tiny elite and plunder an entire planet. Liberals, socialists, trade unionists, independent journalists, and intellectuals, many of whom had once important voices in our society, will be banished and muzzled by corporate control through academia, culture, the media, and government. It will create a power vacuum filled by speculators, war profiteers, gangsters, and killers.
Now I'm going to take the unusual step of excising some of what is broadcast on the New World Notes show, because although we try and represent people's views completely and not to censor things on unwelcome guests, we've already got Kenneth Doust's adaption of another adaption of selected readings from Chris Hedges. So I don't feel that I'm misrepresenting Chris Hedges. I find the material needlessly pessimistic. And Chris Hedges ends on an optimistic note, on a call to arms. I am usually very impressed with Chris Hedges' down-to-earth reality, because I think he's faced such extremes of human nature in his war corresponding days. He's seen how people actually behave when they are outside of the norm. And as such, I'm disappointed that he paints a very bleak picture about ecological collapse and most people not realizing until it's too late that they are looked upon as resources, to borrow an analogy from Lynn Gehry, by the companies, the way that we look upon batteries in a flashlight to be used up and then thrown away when they have no further use. So we're going to find time for a little bit more of this at the end, because I think you should hear Chris Hedges' conclusion. But we're now going to hear Robert Jensen. This is an interview by Latin Waves from April the 15th, 2013.
We're very privileged this morning to be joined by Dr. Robert Jensen. He is the author of Arguing for Our Lives. It's a beautiful book, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. Very privileged to have you on our program. Thank you for joining us.
Great to be with you.
Now, we look, you know, at critical thinking as something that, as a terminology of education. People in education often speak about critical thinking. But I find the idea of critical pedagogy that Paul Freire, you know, inspired in the 70s has been completely removed from the critical thinking of today. And so what are we talking about when we're creating critical arguments in order to create dialogue?
Well, I think you're absolutely right that some of the original ideas about critical thinking, such as Freire, as you're saying, were focused on helping people think about power, especially people on the bottom of hierarchies who had to struggle to resist that power. So there was always a politics to that conception of critical thinking, a politics of resistance, you could say, to concentrations of power. But like many things, when they become adopted by big institutions, they lose that political edge. And I think critical thinking is a good example of that. So in my book, I'm trying to talk about critical thinking brought to bear on some of the more fundamental questions about that distribution of power. You know, critical thinking is not some magical power that you have to study to learn. It's really just about recognizing what are the fundamental questions we struggle to answer, and how do we get to those most successfully? Unfortunately, a lot of academic life often is about obscuring those fundamental questions, not highlighting them.
In your book, I was particularly drawn to your chapter on power basics, political, but more than politics. And yep. Here, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the relationship between this kind of elitist view of intellectual life as something that is performed by a particular sector of the population, but not, you know, accessible to the rest of the population.
Right. A lot of academic life, I think, is kind of mystifying what is a pretty basic human ability to systematically look at the world and try to observe patterns and understand how the world works. Now, of course, there are some fields that are highly technical and require a lot of study. I can't tell you a thing about modern physics, for instance, because I haven't put the time in to deal with that very highly technical, complex field. But what I'm concerned about in this book and in my own teaching and organizing is not those very technical arenas, but the more basic questions about how power is distributed, about what it means to live a good life, these kind of basic political and philosophical questions that have animated human beings for a long, long time. And in that realm, I want to argue there's no special skill needed. One has to work hard to try and understand the world. It's a complicated place. But it doesn't take some special training in that sense. The problem is, of course, in contemporary America, and in some sense in the world more generally, there is so much time, energy, and money put into what I think we should just call propaganda, advertising, public relations, marketing, the way that governments and corporations spend a whole lot of money trying to control the way we think. You know, that's not a conspiracy theory. That's just a description of marketing, public relations, and advertising. It's an attempt to constrain the way we think. And so we always have to try and break out of that. And that, to a large degree, also is what this book is about.
We face an epidemic worldwide. In my opinion, violence against women is endemic to the way in which we relate not only to one another, but also to the way in which we treat Mother Earth and, you know, and our own ability to create a world that is sustainable, that that can sustain life. I feel is interdependent with our ability to eradicate violence as a policy of, you know, success or of advancement. How can we engage people who feel that relationships of power are the result of culture, are the result of nature, are the result of natural predetermination?
Well, I think that's a great place to start because, of course, we live in a world with epidemic levels of violence against women, rape, sexual harassment, domestic violence, child sexual assault. And to a large degree, sadly, people often just accept that as normal, as if that's the way human beings have always lived. And of course, these levels of violence are not a permanent feature of human societies if we go all the way back through human history. There are reasons that we live in that very violent world. It's about hierarchies. One of those hierarchies is the hierarchy and patriarchy of men's domination of women. It's not natural. It's a product of a certain development of societies, actually fairly recently, over the last maybe 5 to 10,000 years. And in the scale of human evolutionary history, that's not a very long time. So I think you're pointing out the need to denaturalize, to challenge the normalizing of these kinds of hierarchies. Violence against women is an indication of that hierarchy in gender. Of course, there are other hierarchies. You know, most notably, at this point, the hierarchies around the distribution of wealth, we have a wildly unequal hierarchical society in the economy. It produces a world in which some people have access to resources that are almost beyond description, while the majority of people on the planet live in some level of poverty. Well, that violates everyone's fundamental moral precepts. I don't care if one is religious or secular, we all have some set of moral principles that depend on recognizing the inherent dignity of all people. And you cannot have a world that honors the dignity of all people with this kind of heavily skewed distribution of resources. So a lot of what I think we have to do in terms of intellectual work these days, and again, we're using the term intellectual not in an elitist sense, not the kind of thing that only people with advanced degrees can do, but a description of the hard work of trying to understand the world. I think one of the most important intellectual tasks today is to break through this assumption that hierarchies are natural, they're inevitable, that there's not much you can do to change them, and to reclaim that deeper spirit of an egalitarian quest for a more equal world in which, in fact, the dignity of all people can be achieved.
In your book, you ask us to think courageously and to reframe ourselves and our world. How do you invite your students to think about what it means to be human, what it means to be a member, you know, among a great family that is sustained by nature?
You know, old people, I'm in the category of old people now, I'm 54 years old. Old people these days love to talk about how young people don't understand things, you know, don't pay attention, don't read enough, too busy playing games. And of course, I think it's appropriate to ask critical questions about the cultural practices of young people. And the point is twofold. One is the question arises, if we don't like what young people are doing, they're too obsessed with texting on their phones or something like that, which old people love to talk about. There's an obvious question. Who created the world in which these young people are living? Well, we did. Old people did. So we're responsible for the practice. The second thing I think is really important is I think often young people have a clearer bead on reality than my generation does. For instance, when I talk to first-year classes of 18, 19-year-olds, and I ask them to reflect on, for instance, the ecological crises, they're all very aware that they're going to live their lives in a world that is in a very, very severe crisis around health of the larger living world, They don't have any illusions about that. In fact, I think they're often much more clear about it than older generations are. And so I find that when I address these things openly and honestly and ask students to imagine what a decent world would look like, what are the values that would animate such a world, they can do it pretty easily. They talk about the need for a world in which people can live a dignified life. They talk about the problems of inequality. They talk about, you know, the lack of a sense of community often. And they know what's going on. And the goal then is to help them analyze why we're in the position we're in. Why is it that in this society wealth is so unevenly distributed? Why do most people in a allegedly democratic society feel completely shut out of the political system? Why do we live in a world where everybody understands we are degrading the environment and yet nothing seems to stop it? These are questions that I think are very much on the minds of young people, and all we have to do is create a climate in which they can pursue this kind of questioning.
I was recently at the World Social Forum in Tunis, and I was struck by the kinds of discussions that were taking place around the issue of violence against women. And in many ways, I find that there's a certain bigotry about ideas from the West being superior to anything outside. And so I wonder if we could talk a little bit about how this arrogance of our superior knowing not only corrodes but impedes our ability to create and reframe our world in ways that can be more egalitarian, more inclusive, and reflective of our humanity.
Yeah, that's a great point, and I think there's a really valuable lesson in it. So let's take probably the symbol of repression of women in Muslim societies or Arab societies, the burqa, the societies in which women are covered completely so that there is no individual expression. Well, I happen to think that's a cultural practice that's hard to defend. I don't think the burqa leads to a society that's going to promote gender equality. But think about contemporary America. I'll use my home country, which I think is appropriate, where women are routinely encouraged to parade themselves in public in really as sexual objects. Maybe the article of clothing most illustrative of this is the thong. All right, so women in the United States are encouraged to parade themselves for the sexual pleasure of men, whereas women in other societies are forced to cover themselves completely. Are either one of those practices that are likely to produce gender equality? Well, I don't think so. I'm a critic of both of those practices. And so the question arises, well, which is worse? And I think that's the wrong question. The question isn't, do women have it better in the U.S. than they do in Afghanistan, let's say. Well, maybe in certain ways, of course, they do. Women have more freedom in the United States than in Afghanistan. But if you look beyond that superficial analysis, you see deeply embedded patriarchal practices that are really about men's control of women's bodies. And it doesn't matter, you know, which is worse. It matters whether we have the courage to see the underlying problem, the problem of patriarchy. And before we spend all of our time condemning other societies, we do a little critical self-reflection about our own. I think our ability to be part of an international movement, for instance, for gender equality, is much enhanced if we will deal with the problems that we have at home. And there are real problems at home. Those levels of sexual violence you mentioned earlier are, again, not natural. They're a product of a cultural understanding of what women's bodies are for. And so there's a lot of work we need to do at home on that before we start assuming we can correct the problems of the world.
I also wonder if you could comment about the context, because, well, in North America, we could argue that there are certain freedoms, perhaps, that women have struggled for. I mean, women weren't always perceived as independent agents in their own right in this country either. You know, back in 1900s, women were ownership, you know, they were property of men as well. So can we talk about the way in which we tend to objectify the struggles of others when we deny, well, perhaps not deny, but ignore the context in which that struggle is taking place?
Sure. I mean, I think this is one of the great questions of the modern world. We've made great strides toward understanding that people are people, that every one of the 7 billion people on this planet has exactly the same moral status, the same claim to a dignified life. We recognize there's essentially no difference between me and people living a half a world away in moral terms. And we've developed a concept of universal human rights, of the idea that one's right to certain things shouldn't depend on where one lives or what culture one is born into. If we believe in the rights of women, then we have to believe in that in a universal sense. But of course, cultural practices do differ, and it's often easier to see the problems in cultural practices of another society than of our own. So we're constantly both trying to make good on this claim of universal rights and support the struggles of people in other cultures for claiming those rights. And yet we also have to be critically self-reflective. Now, as you're pointing out, the West, you know, whatever that means, Europe, the U.S., Canada, these kinds of societies, have often been much better at critiquing others and then using that critique, for instance, as a justification for violence, not necessarily because we're all that concerned about universal human rights, but because that becomes a wedge through which we can justify violence. Certainly, when the U.S. invaded Afghanistan after 9/11, the justification for that was often phrased by the Bush administration as partly a quest to free the women of Afghanistan from patriarchal rule. Well, you know, that was a cover story. I don't think anybody in the Bush administration particularly cared about the status of women in Afghanistan, as evidenced by the way they abandoned such concerns the minute they're not useful for political propaganda. So that's the struggle. I mean, I believe in human rights, and I believe that the cause of human rights can often be misused by powerful nation states. Both things are true. And, you know, like most things in this very complex world, we have to struggle to figure out how to keep those things in balance. But that's what it means to live in a democracy. And we have not only, I think, a right to do that, but we have an obligation to struggle to do that, to try and work this out.
To me, it's been convoluted, you know, the idea of democracy with capitalism, and it's something that I feel we need to not only demystify, but also critique in a way that helps us move away from it.
Right. If you read the political science literature, those folks often talk about how capitalist economies are essential to democracy because capitalist economies create stable middle classes who can participate in politics, and there's a whole argument, and there's some truth to that. But at a more profound level, everyone understands that democracy and capitalism are fundamentally incompatible for a very simple reason. Whatever else one thinks about capitalism, it is a wealth-concentrating system. The capitalist economies all concentrate wealth to different degrees. You know, you can see different levels of that concentration of wealth in different societies, but every capitalist economy is a wealth-concentrating system. In the United States today, it's a particularly obscene disparity between the wealthy and ordinary people. But whatever one thinks about any of that, if you concentrate wealth, it's quite clear you are going to concentrate political power. Folks often talk as if economics and politics are in these separate arenas, which is ridiculous. It's all in one arena, and the concentration of wealth affects the distribution of power. And it's a very simple observation. You cannot have an economic system that concentrates wealth and expect to have a political system which distributes power. And we see that today in the United States. The most obvious way we talk about it is the effect of money, the effect of wealth on the political process. A lot of people in the United States, you know, we talk about elections, but a lot of people don't feel like we have meaningful elections because vast amounts of money are spent to affect the outcome of those elections. And beyond two political parties spending money to try and win, the more important effect of this is that if one doesn't have access to that level of funding, one doesn't even get in the game. You see that contemporary corporate capitalism has undermined democracy.
How should we conceptualize or imagine ourselves being free? In your book, you quote, "We are most free when we are most bound to others." Can you speak about this?
Yeah, there's a chapter in the book where I deal with kind of aphorisms, phrases that challenge us. I'm a big fan of kind of pithy phrases that make us think. And one I've always been fond of is this claim I often make that we are most free when we are most bound to others, which kind of is counterintuitive. After all, at least in the United States, we're taught that you're free when you don't have to listen to others. But we also understand that, you know, as everyone says, we're a social animal, that our lives have no meaning in isolation. We don't live as individuals. I'm not here talking about some mystical great common spirit or something. I mean, I realize that I'm an individual with my own thoughts and ideas. No meaningful life is lived in isolation from others. In fact, most of how we understand ourselves, the meaning we create in our own lives, is the product of that interaction. And when those ties to other people, communal ties, are weakened, we often feel, understandably, kind of adrift. We don't really feel free. We may be free in some sort of technical sense. We may be free of the constraints of other people. But that's not the way one lives a meaningful life. So real freedom is about that, again, the complex working out of individual differences within a community, a group of people who are committed to living together. That's where the meaning of life comes from. And so the chance to live free, I think, is enhanced when we are more aware of and more committed to those communities. We see the effect of the atrophying of those communities all around us in the United States. I hear this all the time from students who grow up in the suburbs of big cities in Texas, like Houston or Dallas. And a common complaint they have is that they grew up in a world with no meaning. These are often very affluent students. They grew up with every material thing they could need, and they are searching for some sense of meaning because the community they came from was not a community in any real sense. So they had a lot of freedom, but that freedom in that very narrow sense didn't answer the deeper human longing for connection.
Can we talk a little bit about this aggressive sense of, I guess in your way you call it arrogance, you know, this arrogant way of knowing that imposes a technological solution to problems that are both political, ecological, social, and economic?
To borrow a phrase from one of my favorite thinkers, Wes Jackson, what you're talking about is the failure of success. If we take the last 200, 250 years of human history, the Industrial Revolution, the way in which human beings, the ability to exploit the dense energy in coal, oil, and natural gas. Well, it's been very successful in the sense that we've created a lot of material comfort, at least for those of us in the more affluent parts of the world. We can transport ourselves in a matter of minutes over distances that used to take days. We have more of everything. Well, all of that seems to be a marker of success. But in fact, we can also see it as a failure. It's successful in the short term in producing an abundance of material goods, but it doesn't, first of all, answer that question about where do we find meaning. And in industrial societies, you see large chunks of the population struggling with anxiety and depression, not because that's a natural phenomenon, I think, but because it's a product of a culture without meaning. And as you're also pointing out, this success in material terms is having a long-term cost on the ability of this larger living world, which we're dependent, the ability of that world to support a large-scale human presence. You know, you can think of it as the bills for the Industrial Revolution are finally coming due, and the bill is much bigger than we could have imagined, and we have no way to pay it. The last roughly 10,000 years of human existence on the planet, when we started agriculture, we started building cities, we started exploiting the larger living world more efficiently, so to speak. Well, that's the period we call civilization. And it turns out that civilization is in some ways extremely uncivilized. It produces societies with great disparities of wealth and power. It produces hierarchies that we feel is sort of at odds with what it means to be a decent human being. And it's destroying the ecological basis for our own lives. Well, that doesn't seem very civilized. It seems pretty crazy. So we've got to find a way to learn from the past, not because we can romantically think we can recreate the past, but because we have to chart a different kind of future. And the first thing is to recognize that very basic concept that the Industrial Revolution is, in a sense, a story of the failure of success. And once we acknowledge that and stop pretending that we're just going to magically continue this incredible assault on the ecosphere, well, then the quicker we get down to trying to make a decent life for ourselves on this planet.
Thank you so much for being with us, and thank you for writing this very insightful book, Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. I wonder if you could, in parting, you know, tell us what inspires you? What inspires you to imagine not only a world transformed, but a people engaged and able to create those kinds of relationships that can help us live in a different way?
A long time ago, I realized that the most fun I could have in life was to take on these critical questions and to align myself with others who were willing to make those critiques. I think we have a moral obligation to participate in social movements that challenge concentrated power, but we also have to remember that it's a very rewarding way to lead one's life. I feel particularly kind of fortunate as a professor with a lot of autonomy and a lot of choices, to be able to work with people in things like the immigrant worker movement or the worker cooperative movement, two activities I'm involved with a lot these days. That's where the kind of joy comes from. So, you know, I always want to point out to people that making a commitment to social justice, to movements for ecological sustainability, is not simply a sacrifice. In fact, there's a rich and rewarding life and engagement with amazing people when you make those choices. And that's what we have to always remind other people. It's not a sacrifice to live your life this way. In fact, in many ways, it helps provide the meaning that the dominant culture doesn't give us. And so I encourage folks who are struggling to realize that and recognize over the long haul what that kind of choice can mean for you. It's certainly been a great source of joy in my own life.
And that wasn't Robert Jensen at the very end there. If you listen carefully, you'll have detected a musical thought for the day by Sick Note. Now, in return for the conclusion of Kenneth Doust's adaptation of Obey, based on the work of Chris Hedges.
We will either defy the corporate elite, which will mean civil disobedience, a rejection of traditional politics for a new radicalism, and the systematic breaking of laws, or see ourselves consumed. The future, if we obey, will be wrested from us. Acts of resistance are moral acts. They take place because people of conscience understand the moral rather than the practical imperative of rebellion. They should be carried out not because they are effective, but because they are right. Those who begin these acts are always a few, but no act of resistance is useless. We must trust that resistance is worthwhile. The media, the arts, scholarship, and political and social movements must become conduits for unvarnished moral outrage and passion. We must defy systems and even laws that permit corporations to strangle our culture, but they will hate us for it. All who speak in a moral voice, one tied to facts rather than illusions, will become freaks. A culture, once it no longer values truth and beauty, condemns its most creative and moral people to poverty and obscurity. And this is our destiny. The corporate elite will label us the enemy. They will condemn the rebel as impractical. They will dismiss the stance as counterproductive. They will chastise the rebel for being angry. They will use the hypocritical language of compromise, generosity, and understanding to argue that we must accept and work with the current systems of power. But the rebel is not concerned with self-promotion or public opinion. The rebel knows that, as Augustine wrote, hope has two beautiful daughters, anger and courage. Anger at the way things are and the courage to change them. This defiance, this capacity to say no, is what mass culture and mass propaganda seeks to eradicate. As long as we are willing to defy these forces, we have a chance. If not for ourselves, then at least for those who follow. Acts of rebellion permit us to be free and independent human beings. But rebellion is not the same as revolution. Revolution works towards the establishment of a new power structure, and we cannot repeat the mistake of revolution. Rebellion is about perpetual revolt and permanent alienation from power, and it is only in a state of rebellion that we can hold fast to moral imperatives that prevent a descent into tyranny. Hope is a word that is applicable only to those who grasp reality, however bleak, and do something meaningful to fight back, which does not include the farce of elections and the involvement in mainstream political parties. Hope is about fighting against the real forces of destruction, not chanting "Yes, we can" in rallies orchestrated by marketing experts, or just begging Obama to be Obama. Hope in the hands of realists spreads fear into the black heart of the corporate elite. But hope, real hope, will remain thwarted by a collective self-delusion unless we choose it to be otherwise. We will either obey or rebel.
And we conclude with a November 2012 talk, From Endless Growth to a New Form of Democracy. This is by pretty regular speaker on the show, Nafees Mossadegh Ahmed.
Humanity faces a momentous period of transition. Modern civilization is not only in crisis, it confronts a multiplicity of overlapping global crises that are potentially terminal. We're all aware of the devastating findings of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The worst case scenario on a business as usual trajectory, you're all aware. Global average temperatures will rise by 6 degrees Celsius by the end of this century. An uninhabitable planet. We now know that this scenario is actually very conservative. The IPCC didn't sufficiently account for the interconnected complexity of global crises. Arctic sea ice coverage, as we've just heard, is now at the lowest level it's been for a million years. It will likely disappear in the summer of 2015. But what does this mean? This has real serious implications. The loss of summer sea ice is linked to the accelerating melt of permafrost, releasing the vast underground stores of methane, about 30 times more potent as a greenhouse gas than carbon. The process is happening much faster than anticipated. Methane concentrations in the Arctic are now averaging about 1.85 parts per million. This is the highest it's been in 400,000 years. If this reaches a tipping point, we could trigger a process of unstoppable runaway global warming, and we could see a rise of 8 to 10 degrees Celsius by the end of this century. Scientists also link the Arctic melt to our increasingly extreme weather. It will mean more colder, stormier winters in the UK and Northern Europe. This, in turn, will damage British and European agriculture. With 4/5 of the United States in drought, prolonged droughts in Russia and Africa, and a lighter monsoon in India, all due to climate change, we're already seeing a global food supply crash that will precipitate dramatic food price spikes. This alone, by itself, will lead to unprecedented food riots in poor countries around the world. By mid-century, if we fail to act, world crop yields could fall by as much as 20 to 40% due to global warming alone. Imagine what this would look like if you factored in other things like energy depletion. In 2010, the International Energy Agency acknowledged that world conventional oil production had most likely peaked in 2006. Future production relying increasingly on unconventional sources like tar sands, oil shale, shale gas, all will be increasingly expensive. But there's been a lot of industry hype, and it's promised to reduce these costs dramatically with new drilling technologies, namely fracking. But this just isn't true. Despite the US having increased its total supply by about 2.1 million barrels per day since 2005, world crude oil production overall has remained largely flat since that very year. Writing in the journal Science, Sir David King, he's our former UK government chief scientist, he confirms that unconventional oil and gas will not be able to produce sufficiently cheap liquid fuels at the same rate as conventional oil. Production rates at shale wells drop off by 60 to 90% within the first year of operation. You don't hear this in the news. Sir King also argues that oil companies have overestimated world oil reserves by about a third. So we're in trouble, folks. To make matters worse, a typical frack job uses about 4.5 million gallons of water. That's what New York City consumes within about 7 minutes. As climate change intensifies then, and drought gets worse, it will make fracking more unsustainable and costly. The problem is that every major point in industrial food production is heavily dependent on fossil fuels, on-site machinery, production of artificial fertilizers, processing, packaging, transport, and storage. About 10% of energy consumed in the US yearly is used by the food industry. So as oil becomes more expensive, this will place massive strain on industrial food production. And it won't be just food. By 2030, on our current course, climate change alone will lead to deaths worldwide of over 100 million people and a 3.2% reduction in global GDP. What happens when we factor in the impact of peak oil? A study this year in the leading journal Energy, again, not heard it in the news, concluded that world oil supply has not increased since 2005, that this was a primary cause of the recession, and that the expected impact of reduced oil supply will mean the financial crisis may worsen. What happens when we factor in the interconnected feedback effects of water scarcity, food riots, civil breakdown, mass migration, state failure? The cost will be amplified tremendously. This is because the growth that we've experienced over the last decades has been tied inextricably to the systematic expansion of debt. Although total world GDP is around $70 trillion, global external debt is at $69 trillion, and global public debt is 64% of global GDP. Meanwhile, the total size of global derivatives trading, the debt-based speculation which got us into this mess, has risen from $1,000 trillion in 2008 to $1,200 trillion this year. An estimate. A number with no relation to the real economy, clearly. It's no coincidence that debt and derivatives have both intensified at the same time, because the speculative investments designed to benefit the 1% are being bailed out by the 99%. So it's only a matter of time before these costs catch up with unsustainable debt. It's time to wake up to the fact that the conventional economic model has run out of steam. Having outlasted its welcome, it's now leading us along a path to self-destruction. The heart of the problem is the skewed structure of our current form of capitalism, which makes endless material growth at any cost a seemingly rational, logical imperative. What is this structure? Let's pin it down. It comes down to who owns the earth. Today's capitalism is based on a completely unnatural condition, where approximately 1% to 5% of the world's population own the entirety of the planet's productive resources, as well as the technologies of production and distribution. This is the outcome of centuries of colonization, imperialism, and globalization, which has centralized control of the Earth's resources into the hands of a few. With the entire planet subjected to the unrestrained logic of endless growth, we're witnessing the accelerated degradation of our natural environment, our resource base, our financial system, as well as our own well-being. These are not separate crises. They are interconnected symptoms of a global crisis of civilization. So how do we respond? We must first awaken to the reality that this isn't the end, but the beginning. What we are witnessing is the collapse of the old paradigm, which, hell-bent on planetary suicide, isn't working. By the end of this century, whatever happens, civilization in its current form will not exist. The question we must ask ourselves is this: what will we choose to take its place? As a species, we're on the cusp of an evolutionary choice. Standing at the dawn of this perfect storm, we find ourselves at the beginning of a process of civilizational transition. As the old paradigm dies, a new paradigm is born. And many people around the world are already making the evolutionary choice to step away from the old. Local communities and grassroots activists are co-creating this new paradigm as I speak from the ground up. In Greece, locals in Athens gave up their salaries to form an eco-village, producing their own food, building sustainable houses, decreasing reliance on money. As austerity wipes out jobs and businesses, the eco-village has become a citizen's hub, giving advice, running workshops, and independent living. In the UK, there are 43 communities producing renewable energy through cooperative ownership structures. These projects are established and run by local residents. They collectively invest their own time and money to install local wind turbines, solar panels, hydroelectric power. The borough of Woking in Surrey is a really good example. They produce 135% of their electricity from renewable energy sources, and they sell energy back to the grid. They earn revenue that feeds back into the local economy. In 2008, 200,000 US households were living off-grid, sourcing their own water, generating their own electricity, managing their own waste disposal. 2 years later, this had jumped to 750,000 households, and it's now rising by about 10% a year. Across the Western world, altogether, there are now 380 transition towns. Their citizens are actively collaborating to make urban life resilient to fossil fuel depletion. and climate change. The new paradigm is premised on a fundamentally different ethic in which we see ourselves not as disconnected, competing units, fixated on maximizing consumerist conquest over one another, but as interdependent members of a single human family. Our economies, rather than being assumed to exist in this vacuum of unlimited material expansion, are seen as embedded in wider society. Economic activity for its own sake is recognized as the pathology that it is. Economic enterprise, which we still value, becomes aligned with the deeper values that make us human. Values like meeting our basic needs, education and discovery, arts and culture, sharing and giving. The values which psychologists say contribute to well-being and happiness, far more than mere money and things. And in turn, our societies are seen not as autonomous entities to which the whole of the planet must be ruthlessly subjugated, but rather as inherently embedded in the natural environment. These grassroots endeavors are pointing us towards a vision, a very coherent vision in which people reverse their irrational investments in counterproductive conflict. Over the last decade, under the old paradigm, we've steadily increased world military spending by about 4.5% annually. In 2011, world military spending totaled $1.74 trillion, rising 0.3% from the preceding year. It just flattened due to the financial crisis. Imagine what we could achieve if we transferred these absurdly huge expenditures on war preparations for the nation into development concerns for the species. Study after study proves that we could successfully transition to 100% global renewable energy infrastructure within the next 30 years. If we made that choice, the cost of the transition would be no more than 1% of the annual national budgets of world governments combined. This implies, however, not just, you know, sending home armed forces, reducing unnecessary weapons production, curtailing the influence of the military-industrial complex. We must convert that very industrial capacity by retraining our workers in the defense industries, re-employing them in the new industries of sustainable peace that can underpin post-carbon civilization. This will generate a new sustainable form of prosperity. Even by today's completely inadequate standards of investment, by 2020, some 2.8 million people in Europe will be employed in the renewable energy sector. This will boost GDP by some 0.24%. Again, imagine, what could we achieve if hundreds of millions of households across Europe came together in their communities to invest their collective resources into each becoming owners and producers of energy? The new energy paradigm is not about corporate-dominated mega-projects. It's about empowering small businesses and communities. Up to 70% of energy is lost in transmission over large distances. So there's massive potential for efficiency gains when power is produced and consumed closer to the source. This model where households, communities, and towns become producers and consumers of clean energy is already being scaled up in Germany with a great deal of success. 20% of the country's electricity comes from renewables. And 51% of those, all the distributed energy generation, is owned by individuals, not by utility companies. This is huge. This is a new paradigm being born as we speak. And it also applies to food. On the one hand, we need to put an end to the inefficiency of the industrial food system. One third of global food production is lost or wasted every year. On the other hand, we must shift away from resource-intensive forms of traditional corporate-dominated agriculture. In many cases, we will find that smaller-scale forms of organic farming, which are more labour-intensive, though less energy and water-intensive, can be more sustainable than current industrial practices. Communal organic farming offers immense potential, not only for employment, but also for households and communities to become local owners and producers in the existing food supply chain. In poorer countries, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food finds that small-scale organic methods of farming could double food production. And a recent University of Michigan study concludes that no pesticide, local forms of organic agriculture, again, no artificial fertilizers, could theoretically be scaled up to sustain high nutritional requirements for not just the entire global population, but potentially an even larger population of 11 billion people. This new paradigm of distributed clean energy production, decentralized farming, participatory economic cooperation offers a model of development free from the imperative of endless growth for its own sake and leads us directly to a new model of democracy. based not on large-scale hierarchical control in the representative form, but on the wholesale decentralization of power itself towards smaller local ownership. In the new paradigm, households and communities become owners of capital in their increasing appropriation of the means to produce energy, food, and water themselves. This will ensure that critical decisions about production and distribution of wealth take place in communities by communities, driving political empowerment. But participatory enterprise requires commensurate mechanisms of monetary exchange, which are transparent, free from the fantasies and injustices of the conventional model. In the new paradigm, neither money nor credit will be tied to the generation of debt. Banks will be community-owned institutions, fully accountable to their depositors. And whirlwind speculation on financial fictions will be completely replaced by equitable investment schemes in which banks share risks with their customers and divide returns fairly. The new currency will not be a form of debt money. It will be, if anything, linked more closely to real-world assets. But equally, the very notions of growth, progress, and happiness will be completely, radically redefined. We now know, thanks to research by the likes of psychologist Oliver James and epidemiologist Richard Wilkinson, that excessive wealth in the West has not only failed to make us happy, it has proliferated mental illness and widened social inequalities, which are scientifically linked to the prevalence of crime, violence, drug abuse, teenage births, obesity, I could go on. This doesn't mean that material progress is irrelevant, but that when it becomes the overriding force of society, it is dysfunctional. So we must accept that the old paradigm of unlimited material acquisition is in its death throes. The new paradigm of community cooperation is far more in tune with both human nature and the natural order. This new paradigm may well still be nascent. You know, you don't see it around everywhere. You see it in small pockets, small seeds planted in these disparate places. But as the crisis of civilization accelerates over the next decades, communities everywhere will become increasingly disillusioned and angry with what went before. And in that disillusionment with the old paradigm, the seeds we're planting today will blossom and offer a vision of hope that will be irresistible tomorrow. There's only one question that remains, and I ask you, and I ask you to ask yourselves, are you going to hold fast with the grip of death to the old paradigm? Or will you embrace life to become an agent of the new paradigm of community cooperation?
This show and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. I hope this show has helped you to understand more of the vast machine to perpetuate hopelessness, and I hope it will encourage you to spread hope that, for example, laws, politics, government, corporations are only existing in people's minds, and that once enough people have an alternative story in which they believe enough, perhaps one which emphasizes the importance of love for our fellow man and for the natural world, rather than the accumulation of stuff, then we could change our behavior in an instant and face real world issues of climate change, a degraded ecosystem, start looking at the real world together rather than as adversaries, with an attitude of what can we give rather than what can we get.